your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Tuesday night, November 11, 2025. It's Veterans Day. And to all the vets and current active military members listening to this episode, we thank you for your service. In this episode, our James Fegan will be checking in from Las Vegas as he's at the MLB GM meetings. He'll share with us what he's hearing about the White Sox offseason pursuits, and we'll touch base with what's going on around Major League Baseball, including an indictment filed against Cleveland pitchers Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz for gambling. Plus, I'll have James and Jim pick apart my offseason plan project, a reminder that you can still submit your offseason plans at SoxMachine.com in a future podcast episode. I'll be inviting those who submit plans to join me to defend their ideas and how the White Sox should handle this offseason. But first, we do have White Sox news as they officially hired Derek Showman as their new hitting coach. Former White Sox hitting coach Marcus Thames will be joining the Kansas City Royals coaching staff in 2026. Showman is joining the White Sox as he was the ex-Miami Marlins assistant hitting coach, a similar role he served with the Minnesota Twins for two seasons. White Sox general manager Chris Getz shared his excitement about the hire.
It's exciting for us to, you know, make the announcements on welcoming Derek Showman and Sherman Johnson to our organization. Derek being our new hitting coach at the major league level is a delight. As you guys will get to know him, he's very high energy, very intelligent. He brings real grit to the position. His track record is strong, and his journey to this position is an impressive one. And we're very excited to have him join our team. Additionally, Sherman Johnson is our minor league hitting coordinator. I think it's worth noting that, any of these hires, we were really looking for someone that would align with our entire hitting group, starting with Ryan Fuller. And, we were able to accomplish that with Derek and Sherman. Both had pre-existing relationships with them, so there was early familiarity. And as Will and others in the front office worked through the interview process, it was very clear that Derek and Sherman were going to be significant adds to the organization, and look forward to letting them get to work and making the White Sox better.
White Sox manager Will Venable continues his Lead with Empathy course by highlighting Showman's ability to connect with people as a key attribute to his hiring.
The human beings that we're adding to the organization, very excited about. Both of these guys come with a reputation around the league for being quality people who are able to build relationships. And we know that that's something that we value and is impactful when we're trying to figure out the best way to help our players get better. And certainly, Derek has the ability to, have an understanding of what it is we want to do to help people get better, and then have the ability to build the relationships to make those things happen and to leverage those relationships to help our players be the best versions of themselves. And you talk about, individually what they mean, but to Getzy's point, the alignment across the organization to have hitting guys throughout the organization with Sherman and Fuller and that are able to complement each other well and also carry out the same vision is something that we're really excited about.
MLB.com Scott Merkin during the press conference asked Chris Getz an interesting question in regards to the heavy turnover at hitting coach for the White Sox. Since Greg Wagner left in 2011, the White Sox had six different hitting coaches in their last 13 seasons. Getz addresses why there's been heavy turnover at that position and the difficulty of the hitting coach position in general being key factors.
Certainly can't speak for all of the hitting coaches that have been here, but my time here with the White Sox, there have been a handful of different hitting coaches. And, I think that speaks to the difficulty of the role. Because beyond just, the White Sox, the industry is making changes to that position more often than other roles. And, in knowing that and looking at that, I do think that perhaps the hitting coach position has been evaluated, probably through a lens or perhaps in a way that is not fully accurate. So in an effort to centralize our hitting approach, our hitting department, that's why we brought Ryan in to oversee everything, very similar to what we did on the pitching side, because it really isn't just one person. Obviously, that in Derek's case, he's he's in a vital role, being that he's working closely with our major league hitters. He's going to communicate with Ryan Fuller. He's going to communicate with Joel and Sherman, just so we have a system that's being carried out. But really, if you take a step back and you assess hitting or pitching as a whole, there's so much that goes into it. Whether it be who you're acquiring, certainly the tactics that you're developing players, and that really, it comes from me. It does. The general manager of the organization, when there's failure in the hitting or the pitching, I don't want to just point at one person, because I just don't think that's fair. Now, it from day one, it's really been about, committing to the building a foundation for this organization. And in doing so, it's making sure that we have systems built in each of these areas. So the stronger we get, in each, whether it be the hitting space or the pitching space, that should allow these guys to go out there and be more consistent in their roles because of, what has been laid out in front of them. So, our hope here is that everyone, certainly on this call and in the organization, can be here for a long time. That means that we're having a lot of success. We're continuing to develop players, and we're winning more baseball games. And knowing that that's what we were looking to accomplish in this hiring process, where we felt that Derek was the right fit at the major league level.
Just like the pitching side, with Brian Bannister serving as the director of pitching, providing top-down leadership for the White Sox, Ryan Fuller serves in a similar role on the hitting side. In year two with the White Sox, our James Fegan asked Chris Getz how Fuller helped with the interview process.
We've talked in the past about how you don't really believe in like changing hitting coaches just to change them, as you kind of elucidated there. But how did having kind of Ryan on staff for a year maybe make you go into this offseason with a clearer idea of what you would wanted in the hitting coach position than maybe beforehand, and how did that wind up helping you align with Derek?
Yeah, I mean, Ryan has helped develop and roll out objectives that are very important when it comes to developing a White Sox hitter, but also how to go about acquiring such players that really can fall into to those objectives. So, in learning more about Ryan as the year went on, and his involvement, whether it be in free agency to the trade deadline, to other moves that we've made, and obviously seeing the development of some players, and maybe some players that didn't take steps forward. We felt like we needed someone that was fully aligned with Ryan and fit into this system, and it was crystal clear that Derek, was a great fit for that, and Sherman, as an addition at the minor league hitting role, was also going to be able to carry out, what Ryan had put in place, and allowing everyone to go out there and accomplish things. So I think, I think the relationship's going to be very natural. I think Darren coming in now, that he's gotten to know us further, we've gotten to know him, that it's not going to take him too long to start building those relationships he probably already has. And perhaps he can speak on that at some point. But we feel very confident that it's not going to take a long time for things to get rolling, just because of Ryan's presence. And it has allowed the whether any candidate, or but certainly Derek, who's taken this job, to know what it looks like, where it needs to go, and hopefully he feels the support to be able to go out there and be a top hitting coach in this game.
Derek Showman is from Glenview, Illinois, attended high school in Glenbrook South. Despite living in the north side of Chicago, he grew up as a White Sox fan.
Obviously, not only growing up in the northern suburbs of Chicago, but growing up a White Sox fan. And I still recall wearing all my White Sox gear that day and bringing a broom and a dustpan to school, walking around the halls with it for that World Series. I think it was what the swept the Astros in 05, right? So yeah, it's super special, man. This is always been home. I really haven't lived anywhere else. Unbelievable opportunity and super grateful for it.
Showman shared his thoughts about joining the White Sox organization and how he fits into the hitting org chart.
Obviously, you have to have like a lead guy and you have it by title, but I very much like to think of this as a co-op, and this is a collaborative group that's working together, all pushing in the same direction, all aligned towards whatever that North Star is. What's awesome about this group is we all have strengths, right? And we all have weaknesses. And because of that, we're going to, like, the contrast there is going to allow us to grow together and continue pushing forward in pursuit of this North Star and continue developing this offense for the White Sox. So, like, truly, we have this group that, although it is a short period of time, we have been interacting on a fairly regular basis, and the conversations have been great. I got an opportunity to spend like 3 days with them in Arizona recently, just cutting it up and kind of, you know, some touch points, some things that we want to prioritize moving forward, getting organized. That's how I like it. This is how it should be in my eyes. I think that, like, yes, I am, you know, my title, the head hitting coach, the guy that I'll roll with the punches and I'll take the credit or the blame for failures. But, like, this is all of us working together in the same direction.
During Showman's journey in becoming a baseball coach, he spent time with the Schaumburg Boomers back in 2012. James Fegan asked how his start went from bullpen coach in Schaumburg to becoming a hitting guru.
Talked about how you had a lot of different roles with Schaumburg. When did you start getting to the point where, like, hitting really became like the primary focus? And now that you are kind of in it, how did kind of experiencing a lot of different roles in a baseball team maybe, you know, affect kind of maybe your holistic approach to hitting?
Yeah, I think, like, I carried like all these different titles in Schaumburg, but I was always super obsessed and interested, inquisitive about like the hitting space. So even when I was a bullpen catcher, I was still talk hitting with guys on that like 2012 Schaumburg Boomers team. And, you know, going into some years a little bit down the road, I think I had like the title of like strength and conditioning coach. So I was like working out with guys and kind of just like loosely overseeing their stuff at the YMCA. But in those conversations, it would still go back to hitting. So even though like I carried multiple titles, maybe gave me some different responsibilities over the years, which is great for just like overall learning those spaces in the game, albeit the Frontier League, right? Still the game of baseball. A lot of those conversations came back to hitting.
Finally, Will Venable stressed in the second half of the 2025 season that the White Sox hitters must be better hitting against the fastball. And we all saw the impact post All-Star break when the Sox hitters started to crush the heater. Fegan asked Showman how he aligns with Venable on stressing the need to hit fastballs.
Following up on kind of what Will was talking about, the conversations you had, how did you guys kind of find alignment on, you know, both what he's trying to accomplish on a team-wide goal, but also still keeping space for you to work, you know, individually with hitters and kind of get in the weeds a bit more?
Yeah, I think like what he's asking is like true, right, and fair. It's like when he says we got to take away or we have to hit fastballs and we need to perform against fastballs, ultimately what he's saying is we have to take something away from that guy. And as he mentioned earlier today, it's like it may not be the heater, it may be something else, but we are committed, we are convicted, we are prepared to take something away from first pitch. And then we will be ready to pivot to whatever the next thing is that we have to do. So it's like that's common goal, I think, just like from the get. And then, you know, practice harder, man. Like we got to up the challenge points. We talk about leveling up, level up the training environments. We want to get as close to the game as possible, as much as we can. We know that in doing so, the likelihood of skill is higher to transition into the game versus us just kind of doing a lot of lower pitch pressure, like feel good stuff.
We at Sox Machine are happy to follow the lead of our friends over at the All Sports Scene and fellow White Sox blogs and podcasts in participating in the Southside Food Drive. Here's how you can help us raise money to help our Chicago neighbors who are in need. Join our virtual food drive to help raise donations to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Every $1 donated helps provide 3 meals, and the generous donations help keep food pantries throughout Chicago stocked. Together, we have already raised more than $20,000 for the food drive. That's more than 60,000 meals. Thank you so much to those who have already donated. If you have the means, any help would be well appreciated. You can join the Southside Food Drive and donate by visiting the events page on SoxMachine.com. Joining me now on the podcast from Las Vegas is Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gents. James, I'll start with you. Excellent questions to both Chris Getz and Will Venable and Derek Showman, the new hitting coach of the Chicago White Sox, during the introduction press conference. We just heard that audio at the beginning part of this show. How could things change offensively for the White Sox by their hire of Derek Showman?
I don't know. We'll see. It remains to be seen. As he acknowledged, they kind of are going in the right direction. A lot of things coming into the, especially in the season, you're seeing them like add a bit more slug to it. I think they're, you know, batting at like performances, runners in scoring position was particularly poor. And that was something that like Miami did pretty well. We were kind of talking with Peter Bendix about it today a little bit during the NL GM session. He's kind of like, kind of everyone's trying to do that. I don't know if we really reinvented the wheel, but certainly that's kind of an emphasis of, they felt like they were seeing kind of the bones of what they wanted to accomplish in terms of swing decisions, in terms of walk rate, and certainly seeing a little bit more power and fastball production, at least in spurts in the second half. They obviously want that to be a lot more consistent, but you know, there's a lot of talk, especially in like Getz's presser, about feeling like there was stuff on the table a little bit in terms of like how they adapt to situational hitting, and obviously that was a reason they underperformed in one run games a lot last year. It's like they just weren't able to kind of really execute in those situations. I don't know if there's like a, you know, specific strategic secret sauce in that. It's probably a number of things, but that's certainly what's being emphasized. And that doesn't necessarily change an approach per se, because I think their old approach was obviously score runs, but they didn't do it enough.
Yeah, and you did ask a good question to Chris Getz, and we heard Getz's response earlier in the show about how Ryan Fuller plays a role. And Getz mentioned not only did Fuller play a role in the interview process for the White Sox to hire Derek Showman, but Fuller is also going to play a role for the Chicago White Sox and what type of hitters that they target in free agency or trade this offseason. Jim, with Derek Showman now officially part of the White Sox coaching staff as the hitting coach, how closely will we have to monitor and how the success is for the White Sox against the fastball in 2026? Because he agrees with Will Venable, maybe it's not always the fastball that the White Sox hitters have to concentrate on, but they do have to figure out a way to take something away against opposing pitchers in 2026. It sure did seem like the White Sox offense clicked post All-Star break when they did concentrate on crushing the fastball.
I think it depends on when, you know, opening day comes around or when spring training rolls around and we see what the roster is and we see, you know, who's been replaced, what, we've been talking about bat speed. If the White Sox make any efforts to address, that shortfall in bat speed, perhaps that changes how many fastballs the White Sox see. And that's part of the reason why the White Sox saw so many fastballs last year. Still, the league leading amount of them or league leading percentage of them was because of just pitchers didn't fear the roster's ability to turn around pitching. And I think the White Sox kind of turned themselves around a little bit, overthinking it or being too defensive against entire arsenals. And so I think they simplified the opponent's pitching strategies for them. And in the second half, I think that was just part of it. Like sometimes they looked overmatched, sometimes they looked beaten, but it was because secondary stuff was typically pretty good. They didn't get just beat on fastballs, 80 pitches over seven innings by a starter who just threw 97 and located it well. So I think, when we get to opening day or spring training, we see what the 26-man roster is going to look like. I think that'll have some say in fastballs. But yeah, I think the idea is that should the plan change and should all of a sudden the White Sox be really weak against changeups like that, we've seen the White Sox teams have weaknesses with that before. Like any lefty with a good changeup is all of a sudden going to throw a quality start. Pretty much you can pencil it in. I think that's the, that's probably the bigger emphasis. So it'll be interesting. Like if it's two straight seasons, just fastball, 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 even if the White Sox have a focus on it, that probably means more about the hitters the White Sox have acquired versus what's being said. But still, yeah, something to look at as this young talent takes more of the playing time is, are they making pitchers pitch them any differently?
And James, part of that press conference for Showman, he mentioned his work with Kyle Stowers, who had a breakout year with Miami last year and really clicked on things. And I enjoyed the story that Showman shared about that approach started in spring training, asking him if he was afraid or tentative, knowing that something was up in the way that Stowers was swinging the bat in spring training. I'm curious on when you get to spring training in February and watching how the new hitting hierarchy works with the White Sox, which of these young players that he's going to be working one-on-one with, and maybe it is someone like Colson Montgomery, but you also alluded to the fact too, a lot of these guys have private hitting coaches and a lot of times that works for them.
I'd say probably all of them.
All of them now these days. Right. And it, Showman did acknowledge the fact that that's part of the gig too, in the hitting coach side, is that he has to reach out to these guys. And it's a weird thing that he has to work in tandem with these consultants, it seems like.
Yeah. I think like every hitting coach knows that's part of the gig at this point. And, you know, someone like, you know, most of the guys in the industry, a lot of them, like, especially coming from the not maybe former big leaguer background, or probably were those guys at a lot of points, or still even work with guys on the side during the off season as a result of that. So I think to some degree, whether, you know, Showman's kind of a part of a newer wave or part of this, you know, iteration of people who come through the hitting industry this way, obviously he was playing independent ball, but like knows people in those circles, it's probably feels less like a foreign body and more like just, you know, people he's already familiar with. So, not to, you know, knock in any other way that, you know, previous coaches connect with them, but I would think, if anything, he's kind of an iteration of this generation of hitting coaches, where that's not going to be unfamiliar to him at all. Not that that should be, you know, unfamiliar to anyone at this point, I think, especially your star players, let alone the White Sox collection of guys trying to stake their claim, where maybe the team is still kind of the loudest voice for them a little bit hitting wise. They have as much chance having some of those guys as anyone at this point, but I think it's just par for the course. And, you know, he's of a generation where that's normal and not really a transition, I would think.
I'm excited to see and what unfolds, especially in spring training, and how Showman helps with the White Sox young hitters. There's at least something to work with. Last year at spring training, there wasn't much to work with for White Sox hitters, but Showman and the White Sox entire hitting hierarchy, Ryan Fuller, they got at least something to work with as far as building blocks going to 2026. With James at the GM meetings in Las Vegas, lots of news going on around Major League Baseball. The MLB awards have already been given out for Rookie of the Year and Manager of the Year. Rookie of the Year, Nick Kurtz won it for the Sacramento A's. Colson Montgomery got a second place vote and finished the top five of the Rookie of the Year voting. On the National League side, Drake Baldwin of the Atlanta Braves won Rookie of the Year and Manager of the Year. This is a rare occurrence. Both Stephen Vogt of Cleveland and Rat Murphy, Milwaukee, back-to-back years, both won Manager of the Year, respectively, in the American League and National Leagues. The Cy Young Award will be given out on November 12th. James was an American League Cy Young voter this year, so you can learn more about his Cy Young ballot later. And the MVP vote will be announced on November 13th. But the biggest sports news, and you wrote about this on SoxMachine.com, Jim, and it is the indictment on gambling charges against former Cleveland pitchers Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz. I should not say former. They're still part of the Cleveland Guardians. They are just suspended indefinitely as this investigation continues. But there's been a warrant for their arrest. Ortiz was already in custody. Clase is outside of the United States. If you're just hearing about this story, both Cleveland pitchers faced 20 years in prison for wire fraud conspiracy, another 20 years for honest services wire fraud conspiracy, another 20 years for money laundry conspiracy, and 5 years for conspiracy to influence sporting events by bribery, according to the federal prosecutors. Folks, you add that up, both of them could be facing 65 years in prison for what has transpired. A lot of this is on Emmanuel Clase, Jim. And it is shocking for someone that was having his best season ever in his career. I mean, he earned Cy Young votes in 2023. But the fact that he is purposely spiking, according to the indictment, sliders on the first pitch so his friends could do prop bet parlays for velocity and the result of the first pitch, and doing this with large sums of money, this is a great way, a fantastic way to get caught by any gambling institution in the world. And I just don't understand why he did this to help out his friends to make some money. It's just, it's bizarre to me. I still can't wrap my head around what Emmanuel Classe was thinking.
I can understand that better than, I guess, allowing the specificity of prop bets, like, you know, velocity. You can bet on velocity being over under on a given pitch. Like, there are too many events to bet on in baseball, for one. Like, it's insane that you can bet on every pitch and then, like, subcategories of every pitch. That seems insane. Also, like, the fact that $450,000 was allowed to be earned on Class A rigged pitches, you know, according to the indictment. Like, that shows that the sports books aren't working too quickly to catch these things. Like, it was 3 years, and it really seemed like after Luis Ortiz got involved and, like, that ramped up the suspicious bets that people started noticing. So the fact that, you know, baseball or the sports books are self-policing, that seems like a little bit of a overstatements based on taking, you know, 3 years to find sufficient evidence. But I can understand Class A to the point where, you know, when it comes to the fact that you're still immensely successful and instrumental in his team's success without, you know, while still, like, making money for his friends, like, that's, you know, when you get down to it and just, like, try to think of, like, the basest, dumbest level of it, like, it's a free money code. Like, that's probably how he saw it, is like, I get to help out buddies without giving them my own money. So sure, I'll spike a slider and I'll still be great and still be an all-star and still win Cy Young votes. So, you know, how can I possibly be caught? Like, that's, I can understand that. It's dumb. It's very misguided. You know, just, it's, yeah, insane, but also, like, yeah, it's, there's, I think, a human element to it that's very understandable, but just the prop bets, like, how can you, like, I'm thinking, like, you know, Ephus pitches.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking, like, the Adam LaRoche Lalob honor to his dad, or like Zach Greinke trying to hit specific miles per hour with this curveball to see, like, how many different kinds he can throw. Like, you know, those weird wrinkles are supposed to be, you know, neat and idiosyncratic and a funny thing that happens, or, like, you know, if somebody loses a grip of a slider or catches a spike and it's a wayward pitch, like, we're supposed to write that off as, like, oh, they are human, they are mortal. But now it's like, you know, this introduces an entire subplots or ulterior motive to weird things that happen in a game that's very unpleasant as a spectator. You know, calls into, you know, integrity if you really want to think like that, and you wouldn't be wrong to do so. And, you know, I think it comes, you know, Class A is dumb, Ortiz is dumb. Like, it just, it's insanely foolish how that, you know, their thought processes were. But the fact that you can have prop bets like this is even more insane to me. Like, those are the adults setting those terms. And, you know, they should be the, like, the, you know, they're the ones overseeing the game, and they should be like, oh, there might be a problem with, you know, gaming 93 miles per hour instead of 95 miles per hour to win a bet. Like, it's very, that it's, I, the more I read about it, the more insane. Like, I didn't realize that was the case. I knew there was, like, at bat betting, and I knew there was pitch by pitch to a certain degree, but, like, velocity and getting that granular is nuts.
Yeah, I'm a betting guy. I had no idea you could bet on velocity. I use, for the podcast listeners, I use DraftKings, the sports book in Illinois, the app to make bets when I want to bet on baseball games. I had no idea you can bet on velocity. And you make a good point. Like, maybe the sports books knew early, but they have to share this information with Major League Baseball, and Major League Baseball maybe needed more evidence that this was really happening, and they just had so much of it until they had to report it to the FBI, and the FBI takes their time with these types of cases, because when they make charges against you, you're pretty much guilty. Like, they just don't throw out charges like this, and it's 65 years for both that they could be facing in prison. And I wonder how this is going to change things with Major League Baseball and gambling, Jim. Like, maybe they do need to take away, well, they did one step. They have limited, you can only bet $200 on live prop bets moving forward. That's, in my opinion, that's still quite a bit of money. It's not on the level of $20,000. I still don't know if that's going to deter anybody else.
Does that make it harder to police, though?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's going to deter anyone.
Like, if the amounts are smaller, it doesn't make it harder to notice that people are betting on rigged pitches.
I wonder if they have to get rid of live prop betting moving forward when it comes to gambling with Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I think the amount of money that Class A was getting, you know, reportedly, is a case where, like, that's, the money's not the driving factor. You know, it's, you know, as Jacob Pomeranking noted, the chair of the Black Sox committee for Sabre, he's saying, like, that's what, you know, Eddie Seacott, Lefty Williams got, like, in 19 World Series. Like, it's not the money, it's just greed. And maybe just ignorance in terms of, you know, or bad advice in terms of what they consider throwing a game or affecting the integrity of the game to be. But, like, rule, you know, the rules posted, Rule 21 is posted in every clubhouse about betting, and just, yeah, it's probably not information. It's probably not, you know, the specific money. It's just greed and being able to make more money either for you or for your friends without having to, you know, give it out of your own pockets. That really seems to be the driving factor. And I think if you just limit it to $200, like, somebody's still making money for free. If that was the rationale before, like, that doesn't remove the rationale. It limits the payout a little bit, but the payouts aren't that big to begin with.
To interject, I guess, breaking news, just that Ken Rosenthal reported that the league is intending to suspend Class A or make suspension decisions on them before spring training, which largely just affects Cleveland's budget since they don't have to pay them if they're suspended.
So the league would be doing Cleveland a favor
if they suspended them, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a no-brainer. No-brainer. With all this evidence, I mean, Emmanuel Class A, I mean, both of them are going to be banned for life, but, like, Emmanuel Class A was having terrific seasons for the Cleveland Guardians. They still figured out a way to overcome that and still win the American League Central and make it to the postseason, and Stephen Vogt has still figured out a way as manager to win back-to-back Manager of the Year awards in the American League. I'm curious on how they feel. I know they can't talk about this because of the ongoing investigation, but once the dust settles, I am really curious on how Stephen Vogt and Emmanuel Class A's teammates feel about what transpired. And because I just, again, the amount of money, you might as well just give it to your friends at that point. Like, major leaguers, just don't get caught in this. Just don't. Now, that's the big news item around Major League Baseball. But of course, with free agency and trades and the GM meetings and James being in Las Vegas. So, James, let's start with that. What have you learned so far from the MLB GM meetings, either from a White Sox perspective or league-wide?
Well, one, Bobby Nightingale just reported that you know, Bobby Nightingale, not Bob Nightingale, the Twins beat writer, not the National Reporter, that Grady Sizemore is going to be...
You're not on real familiar terms with Bob Nightingale, that you're calling him Bobby.
Yeah, just to specify. said Grady Sizemore is going to be the Twins' first base coach.
Wow.
First base coach, but also handle outfield and base running for them. So
Grady Sizemore.
So the Twins are in the White Sox organization. I think that's the big takeaway here, because then they say that they're re-signing him within the org. So, breaking news, the Minnesota Twins are within the White Sox now.
I think more about the coaching staff is probably something we hope to find out more at these winter meetings. You know, they have the hitting and pitching operation squared away. It's certainly at least the intention of how much they're replacing someone like Drew Butera for catching instruction. I think it's something that could be scoped out by this point. I think I have an item on my question list just says Grant Taylor. I think enough time has passed to maybe have an idea of what that direction is going to be, at least in terms of his offseason preparation. I think thinking more, you know, they've at least alluded to considering their surplus of young catching value on the trade market. I think we're at a stage in the offseason where we're going to kind of having those initial conversations about how plausible it is. And you're starting to see some teams talk about whether they're really going to consider trading someone. You know, the Pirates talked about Skeens not being on the move today. The Cardinals have talked about Nolan Arenado very much being so. I think you're at the point where teams are kind of sketching out those larger directives over the course of the season. I don't know if necessarily they have an answer of like, where's Lenin Sosa going to play? Why is your corner infield defense going to be better than it was last year? That's kind of the thing that sunk the infield because they're up the middle. I was rated out pretty well. There's a lot of things I hope to find out. Possibly by the time some listeners are getting to this, hopefully not too many. But yeah, I think there's some initial stages of roster direction that they left unanswered at the end of the season that I, by all means in consideration with, you know, so many pieces in place for next season that they should have ready made answers for when Kent talks on Wednesday.
So is it just first base that the White Sox have left on their coaching staff as far as the big spots?
You know, what their catching coach is going to look like if they have one. You know, so many teams have amorphous major league coaches. Do they have a hole in offensive coordinator that they need to fill now with Grady? So coaching staff's readily expanding, so we don't know what we don't know in terms of you know, what other pieces are going to be filled out until they sketch them. But I think in terms of like how they're going to obviously teach catching, given the young catchers they have at the major league level, that could take various forms, and, you know, replacing first base would be the primary things, but remains to be seen.
Got it. Jim, what are you hoping to learn from the GM meetings?
I think some, I think Getzo is always evasive in terms of budget, but given that I had to think about off-season plan project budgets, I'm waiting for the confirmation at some point in terms of like what the White Sox are actually going to spend or what their biggest investment in the off-season might look like, what their pursuit of relievers might look like, just based on the fact that it does seem like they could use a veteran, but they've been reluctant to do it. And yeah, there's good reason for it. Like we just talked about Class A, like the fact that the Guardians lost Class A and like we're no worse for the wear. Like that's, I think, a very good example of how teams that are good at developing relievers, developing pitchers, don't need to go overboard pursuing proven relievers. Like you tend to be buying on the downside. So the White Sox bullpen was so unsettled and it seemed like they'd be doing Will Venable a favor by adding some capable medium to high leverage guys, at least one of them in that role, but also like the White Sox aren't so close to where like one reliever is going to make a difference materially on whether they're on the fringe of postseason contention or not. So that's a curiosity for me, aside from what James mentioned. And then like, I think just the infield's still a mess with the out of options guys. They could more or less stand pat and roll out an outfield, but also it seems like trades might have to happen depending on how they feel about out of options guys. There are always opportunities to upgrade, like how attached are they to Curtis Meade, given what he showed last year? Like just questions like that, I think, weren't answered definitively towards the end of the season. And, you know, I think for somebody like Meade, if the White Sox like moved on from him in spring training, like, yeah, I'd get it. He didn't show much. And he's kind of on right. This fringe lifestyle. So yeah, I don't know if Getz can answer that, but I think he could probably speak generally about some of it.
Well, for our podcast listeners, especially for those that are Sox Machine subscribers, again, a huge thank you for your continued support of Sox Machine to allow us to have James as he jumped on this podcast from the Cosmo Casino and Hotel in Las Vegas, live from the GM meetings. Again, thank you so much for your continued support to allow us to send James out to the GM meetings. And we are planning to be, again, full force at the winter meetings in early December in Orlando to cover all of the news and action that will be taking place in those days, including the MLB draft lottery, as the White Sox have the best odds to get the number one overall pick. And we'll see if the White Sox duplicate their success in the Rule 5 draft on that Wednesday. So there'll definitely be some type of news that we will be reporting from the winter meetings. But again, thank you so much to our current Sox Machine subscribers. If you are just listening to the podcast and you are not a current Sox Machine subscriber, you can sign up at SoxMachine.com/products, where monthly plans start at $5. And if you sign up for an annual subscription, you get a pretty big discount for doing so. So again, if you aren't a subscriber yet, please subscribe. It helps us a great deal. And then finally, as you mentioned, a few things Jim and the White Sox could focus on. I did post my offseason plan project, which those are still active. As I mentioned in the intro, you can go to SoxMachine.com and you can submit your offseason plan projects. I'm still combing through them. I'm making notes on the ideas that I like the most from the offseason plans, and I'll be inviting you guys on a future podcast episode to defend your ideas. But now I am setting myself up for Jim and James to rip apart my offseason plan. So I'm just focusing on the six free agents that I have the White Sox signing. I don't think the White Sox are going to make any significant trades. I'd almost advocate that they don't, and just keep some of their prospects and seeing how they develop through the offseason going to spring training, because there's not a whole lot of depth right now that the White Sox can provide internally with what they have with the current farm system. I know it is getting better. I know the results of the Arizona Fall League are very promising. Not to slow down everybody's enthusiasm about the Arizona Fall League, but remember, Adam Engel was a former Arizona Fall League MVP. So
why would that slow down someone's enthusiasm?
Probably increases it. What am I thinking?
He made it against considerable odds.
He did make it. He did. So the six free agents that I have, we're going to start in the bullpen. So James, I'll start with you. I think a good target for the White Sox, because we know that they need more lefties in the bullpen, is left-handed reliever Gregory Soto. How do you feel about Gregory Soto being added to the White Sox?
He's left-handed and throws hard, so I get it. I haven't liked where it's going for a while now.
Especially the sinker.
Yeah, like contact rates, zone contact rates are going in the wrong direction. Velo is going in the wrong direction, even if it's still 97 from the left side. Like, it's not a unappealing hunk of clay, but I think it would be, you know, some sort of like, what can you do to change this profile sort of work. And I don't know if I want it to be like, I'm that interested if it's still like market price for a, you know, eighth inning guy type of investment, which, yeah, I think there'd be some right for them to at least pursue that. And so I don't know if that's something that, I don't know if it gets to a price point that I'm super excited about early in this offseason. And, you know, the White Sox are a little bit like, let's get guys for small deals when we can get them as soon as possible sort of approach last year. So it's not like it's worth doing on its own, because like bringing in more talent is worth doing. It's not the project I would pick.
Okay. Then Jim, I'll post Hunter Harvey. So coming from Kansas City, he had the injury in the lower half that really limited how many innings he could throw for the Kansas City Royals. He had success with the Washington Nationals before being traded to the Royals, and I feel like he just needs an opportunity to bounce back. How do you feel about Hunter Harvey joining the White Sox?
I don't, there's a curling term or phrase. I don't hate it. That's a way to offer faint praise of a shot, or like, it's okay, could work against us in time, so I can't get too hyped about it, but we could also maybe use it down the road. So like, let's see how this shot plays out before I issue final judgment. But I would kind of get like, I don't hate it. Like, there are some decent raw ingredients. I think just get a little itchy when it comes to the White Sox and just feeling confident about picking up guys and counting on guys who spent most of the previous year hurts or ended the year hurts. I'm thinking like, speaking of former Royals relievers, like Kelvin Herrera, like he had the foot injury, hampered him. And like, they gave him 2 years and paid him what, $8.5 million or something like that. And he was just compromised from day one, didn't have it. So, like, depends on the deal. But if they sign him to like a 1 year and incentive laden contract or something like that, like, I'd get it. If it were like the guy expected to sop up a whole bunch of those eighth, ninth inning appearances, like, I would not like it as much.
Okay. So far, I'm not feeling great about the
I would
relievers
also
that I
give Gregory
picked
Soto it,
based
and I
on.
don't hate it. Like, see what they say, see what the price is. Like, it's I'd understand it, given especially given the shortage of talent on the left side. But yeah, they'd have to have an idea and be a case of like, what's the price? What did you win a bidding war? And why does that make me nervous?
I mean, at this point, like, not to say like I have like undying faith that whatever they're going to try is going to work, because it's certainly not. But like, I think at this point, when they acquire people, I almost assume they do have an idea. Like, the way they've talked about your assignments working, like, I think anybody who, like, they're announcing a guaranteed deal with, like, Bannister's look at them and like has some path to victory, to use a Will Venableism. So like, I would at least give their operation credit, like when they acquire somebody, like, yeah, there's probably like a Fuller or Bannister endorsement here somewhere that would give me at least like I'm listening sort of like level of approval to anything they do. I don't know
Yeah.
like what level of praise or credibility I'm giving to them. It's just like, I assume you're doing something here. It's
No,
kind of
yeah.
my general reaction to White Sox
I
signings
think it comes
at
down
this
to
stage.
the dollar amount. Like, you know, if they have an idea for Bryce Wilson at 1.05 million, like it's like probably not that strong of an idea, and they're just hoping for something. They'll throw things against the wall, and if it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work, and they can move on easily from it. So like Soto, it's a case where like, you know, what does a dollar value reflect on what kind of idea they have? And then it's a good test of like whether they can see it through.
Like, I wonder if like their idea for Bryce Wilson was like what Yoenis Gomez was, like, is what I imagine, and more in production than, you know, Arsenal, obviously.
Moving over to the starting front, one of the guys that you listed, James, and you pitched to us. I have the White Sox signing Dustin May to a 1 year, $5 million contract to help eat up some innings in the starting rotation. How do you feel about Dustin May joining the White Sox?
It's kind of like the same line where it's like, he obviously wasn't good last year. He's thrown harder in the past. He's been like a top 25 prospect. I assume if he's in the door, they've got like, I'm sure they'd just be gushing about like his raw talent and like what they see in him if they brought him, like, oh, we love the seam effects. There's so much potential here. Like, I can only assume there'd be jazz if they landed him. So like, I can't be like, well, about it now, and then right like 2 weeks from now, if they sign it, be like, well, they're really excited. This is the most excited they've ever been. Like, and everyone knows that I poo-pooed it. But like, he's, I don't know, mixed feelings. Like, I'm definitely like, they would need another plan for who's going to be reliable innings wise. Like, that can't be like, this is our Martin Perez because he threw 130 innings last year. Like, the health history is not there. Like, it's intriguing as like a shot, a chance take. It can't be there. We're protecting our young pitchers with Dustin May type of signing. Like, that's not your, like, your surefire 150 innings that you know you need to get. So if anything, that might signal a more exciting offseason, like, oh, you think you have enough budget room that you feel like you could take this, you know, this shot that doesn't necessarily guarantee you any innings, and you're still going to do more where you do secure it on the back end, because like, it doesn't fit into that peg, that slot. Like, it's too risky to, like, it almost implies another signing to be your main, you know, rotation add.
Well, that was my main rotation ad for my season plan based on the budget allowed, because Jim Anthony K is the other starting pitcher that I have the White Sox signing for $2 million. Is this another I don't hate it idea?
That's like for $2 million, I think it's I don't see the risk, assuming he's healthy. Like that's pretty much the cost of entry for most pitchers with any kind of MLB or draft pedigree plus success overseas, you know, 1 year club option, you know, like what's it, 2.5 million total because he gave him a
Yeah.
$500,000 buyout, but seems fine, especially lefty. Like they can use left-handed depth. So even if he doesn't like stretch out as a starter, and he just lives this kind of long relief, spot starter opener type role, Tyler Gilbert, kind of fills the same thing. It's redundant, but you're not going to find cheaper, I think, for the kind of upside he presents. So, like we talked about with like Martin Perez and Bryce Wilson, like, plan A and plan B for innings, or like, the priority one, but also like, say somebody who might be able to chip in with either some starts or some bulk. And I think like K would fit that second pitcher pretty well.
Yeah. So when you look at the money that I want the White Sox to spend out of the remaining budget for relievers and for starting pitchers, I end up spending majority of my offseason budget on the outfielders, starting with Mike Yastrzemski as a plug-and-play option in right field, James Fegan. How do you like the idea of Mike Yastrzemski, 35-year-old Mike Yastrzemski, joining the White Sox?
I mean, it's I think it's solid logic. I think at that age, you could obviously see like it kind of fall apart, or like their body betray them in a certain degree. But like, I think it fits the need similarly with like probably a bit more, I guess, confidence about where the defense will be. Not that like Tauchman's a bad defender, but obviously he's coming off knee surgeries. It just adds like uncertainty to the profile. I could see like maybe we see like the bat speed fall off a little bit, or like he's just at an age and like the level of like he's not a dominant player. Like a step back is, doesn't necessarily have like regular sort of floor there. But yeah, I think it's a reasonable facsimile of what worked pretty well last year. So I wouldn't see it as like a thumbs up, but I'm not like jumping up and down. Like you did the job. It's like, you're not getting an A on this project, but you were certainly passing and saying nice things to you about your parents.
Thank you, James. All right. So I'll take the faint praise as a positive with Mike Yastrzemski, which leaves the last free agent on the list, Cedric Mullins. And the thinking, Jim, is that Cedric Mullins really needs an opportunity to prove that he can start. He's a 31-year-old outfielder now. Yes, he has been declining since his 6-WAR season, but I feel like he needs a second chance. I would have him play mostly in left field when Luis Robert is healthy, but we know that somebody needs to play center field, and I would still give Mullins those opportunities if you're going to have Robert get days off as a DH, or if he does land on the injured list. How do you feel about Cedric Mullins as a target for the White Sox?
He's interesting in terms of like, would he want to play left field? Would he be somebody who is more valuable as an everyday center fielder? Is there a team that can use him every day in center? Like, the metrics seem to be sharply divided on his ability to cover center field. And I think StatCast is typically, I think Tom Tango has written that StatCast is more reliable with outfielders. Defensive run saves tends to be a little bit better with infielders, video scouting, just because I think there are more subtleties to the position versus outfielders being about like range and jump and in routes and more about like sheer physical talent or instincts being measurable, running straight line speeds for considerable distances. And so like StatCast is fine with his defense, like slightly above average, like defensive run save hates his defense. So it's a case where like, if he's more of a liability or in the process of becoming a declining center fielder who might be stretched in center, then you kind of run into the same issue last year of just having like a little bit of an overinvestment into somebody who's like kind of a backup center fielder and doesn't hit for enough power and left. So it's a case where I feel like he could do better to find everyday center reps, assuming like Luis Robert doesn't get hurt like in spring and create all those opportunities for him. And I think just, having come off the, Andrew Benintendi with a 5-homer season in left field, like, I don't know if the White Sox get all jazzed up. I think it's also a case where you can maybe pick one of Mullins or Yastrzemski, but like having 2 1-year contracts for an outfield feels like maybe they should pursue a little bit more upside of finding a longer term solution for one of the spots, because like Braden Montgomery is hopefully coming, but you still have a lot of uncertainty with the other outfield spots, to where, you know, some of that playing time might be better used for somebody with RBRs left, for instance. So like, whether that's a trade, whether that's an out of options candidate on another roster that the White Sox have room for in their outfield, I think there's more room to play with the playing time you're allowed to afford these guys that other organizations might not be able to.
No, this is good feedback. Good takeaways. So do you like it? Do you hate it? Do you not hate it as far as my offseason plan, Jim?
I think if the White Sox like executed it to the move, you'd see it like this is a more professional product. Yeah, in terms of if everybody is able to take the field in their assigned positions, like it's a case where like if Harvey's not looking like, you know, his peak of the last 2 years coming off of injury, and Soto is just somebody who's not consistent enough to get save opportunities, but is like a major league arm who deserves like medium leverage opportunities. Yeah, I guess I like him just because like they just need so much help from the left side throwing strikes, and he does at least that. So like I think the bullpen would be potentially solved, which is, you know, one of the issues I just talked about. So, you know, that's good. I think starting innings, that's where it gets a little bit dicey.
Yeah.
And then the outfield would be like watchable, like better defensively, helping the pitching staff. So I would get that. But you're also maybe buying into declines, to where like if it doesn't go well in April or May, then what? It would be my reservation. So more watchable product. And I think it's gets you closer to like a win projection that starts with a 7. But then like, have you prepared for 2027, or is it because of the labor uncertainty that you don't consider 2027 to be able to be planned for yet? You know, I guess we'll see as it unfolds. Like your plan may make more sense or may fit in well with how teams are behaving, depending on how scared or apprehensive they are of making commitments beyond 2026.
Yeah, because my mentality is Jerry Reinsdorf is my boss. Like my plan that I attack this from an angle of, I think this is what Jerry Reinsdorf would approve. So if I was actually in Chris Getz's position, I don't know about the multi-years, James. And I guess we'll have to wait, because Jim, everybody makes a great case. Like some of the ideas that I like so far is like Harrison Bader on a 2 or 3 year contract. Okay, that helps you out at one of the corner spots, and you know that Harrison can still play center field when Luis needs time off. Like this would be an opportunity, or even on the starting pitching front, if you want to bring back old friend Lucas Giolito on a 2 or 3 year deal, I'm totally good for that as well. But I have this uncertainty, James. I just don't know how hungry the White Sox are in signing guys to multi-year contracts.
The White Sox signing Lucas Giolito right before a labor impasse. That would be something. I feel like you missed, you mixed being possibly risk averse to a fault with the outfield by being incredibly risky with your pitching construction. I can't tell if I admire it or fear it, but it would be interesting to cover. Dustin May would certainly be an interesting project to watch fall out if the outfielders got sad and old. That I don't know if I would enjoy that as much, but if they flourished, I think they'd be, you know, fun hangs and insightful to talk to. So I don't know what to make of it. My years could vary in quality wildly, which you seem to enjoy. You seem to enjoy when I'm put in chaotic situations.
Yes.
That seems to entertain you. Curious out on how I feel about that too, now that you think about it.
Well, again, you guys can still submit your off-season plans on SoxMachine.com, and we'll have that recap episode. I'm taking a little bit of a holiday. I'll be heading to New Orleans. It'll be my birthday on Sunday, November 16th, so I'll be down in the Big Easy celebrating my birthday. But continue to submit your off-season plans on SoxMachine.com. And that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. James will still be in Las Vegas covering the GM meetings for us, so make sure that you are visiting SoxMachine.com daily as James will continue to report what he is hearing about the Chicago White Sox as he gets a chance to talk to Chris Getz on Wednesday. And of course, more MLB awards will be announced with the Cy Young and the MVP awards upcoming. But if you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. We're starting to do more YouTube shorts. So from all of these press conferences, taking 60-second sound bites from them, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine so you get notified when we do upload those new videos and those new YouTube shorts so you can get access to what the White Sox coaches and front office are saying immediately. You can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. Follow James at JR Fegan. We're also on Blue Sky. We're at SoxMachine.com. James is at JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. I am Josh.SoxMachine.com. I already mentioned it, but thank you again to our Sox Machine supporters for subscribing, allowing us to send James to Las Vegas. If you're not a Sox Machine subscriber but want to be, go to SoxMachine.com/products and sign up. Monthly plans start at $5, and annual subscriptions give you a discount. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all of the Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.